The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, produced by the North Carolina Museum of History. Today I'll be reading to you articles from the fall 2010 edition of the Tar Heel Junior Historian. Antebellum Places is the name of this issue. And the first article is called Opening Windows onto Antebellum, North Carolina, an Introduction to Antebellum Places issue, written by Dr. Lisa Tolbert, who in 2010 was an associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, where she was teaching courses on American cultural history, architectural history, and historical research methods. She earned her doctorate from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her first book focused on antebellum life in small-town Middle Tennessee. Dr. Tolbert served as conceptual editor for this particular issue of the Tar Heel Junior Historian. Imagine for a moment that you have been hired to write a chapter for a North Carolina history textbook of the future. What kind of things would you write about to explain what your daily experience in 2010 was like? What kinds of places might best represent life in the Tar Heel State today? Look around the landscape. Perhaps you would write about supermarkets, gas stations, or big stores like Walmart, for example. What objects might give future students information about life in 2010? Maybe it would be important to describe cell phones, computers, or televisions. What do you have in your bedroom or closet? What work do you do around home or in school? What forms of transportation do you use most often? How do you have fun? Is there one way to describe daily life for everybody in 2010, or do we need to consider different factors, such as whether you live in a big city, in the suburbs, or on a farm? Now think about other ways that those textbook readers might learn about your life. What sources of information would be important for them to study? Do you keep letters? Do you write a diary? Do you send instant messages? Do you have a Facebook page? Do you save receipts when you go shopping or take a lot of photos? What would future museum curators need to collect to tell the story of today's North Carolina? If your house or apartment building is ever preserved as a museum, what kinds of information might it reveal? If your home is a walk-in closet or a television room, for example, what do these ways of organizing space tell us about family life and consumer society in 2010? This issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian gives you the chance to ask some of these same questions about daily life in antebellum North Carolina. The word antebellum actually means before the war. Historians often describe the time from about the 1820s through the start of the Civil War in 1861 as the antebellum era, a time when politics, westward expansion, and economic and social change set the stage for conflict. Your history textbook might describe these years by focusing on such issues as the debate over slavery, the transportation revolution, the expansion of the cotton economy, the Cherokee removal, or reform movements in education, politics, and other areas. These important events help define this distinctive era. Think about other ways of telling the story of the antebellum years. The North Carolina landscape of that time did not look the same as our landscape in 2010. And Tar Heels' responses to some of the questions you just answered would be very different. Consider heading out of your classroom to explore important surviving elements of antebellum days. Together, the articles in this magazine open a window on diverse experiences in an era of important economic and social change. How can we combine information gained from buildings and landscapes with what we discover from other historical sources, like documents, to learn about people's lives? The 1800s got off to a slow start in the state. Faced with exhausted farmland, poor transportation and education, and other challenges to opportunity, thousands of Tar Heels simply left. But North Carolina experienced a building boom in the 1840s and 1850s that began to make it a very different place. Construction of railroads and turnpikes, industrialization, and expansion of commercial agriculture contributed to this boom, which remade the state in highly visible ways. According to North Carolina architectural historian Catherine Beshear, this was a period of such effective and widespread rebuilding that from these years, as from none before, buildings have endured by the hundreds to the present day. The boom improved and expanded existing buildings and produced new kinds of structures, too. County seats constructed grand new courthouses to fit expanding business, and growing religious groups needed new buildings, too. For some wealthier Tar Heels, larger houses with dining rooms and parlors in popular new design styles such as Greek Revival or Italianate replaced one- or two-room log houses. Pay particular attention to the ways that buildings themselves provide evidence of everyday experience that may not be clear from documentary or written sources alone. For example, according to the 1860 United States Census, 80-year-old Rebecca Everett lived with a young woman, the woman's 2-year-old son, and 12 enslaved people at a family farm in Edgecombe County. Today, you can tour the small 3-room house where Rebecca and other members of her household lived, worked, and interacted. If you consider evidence from the census in combination with architectural evidence from the house, does it change your thinking? What does family life in a 3-room house suggest about opportunities for privacy? We might ask some of these same questions about the enslaved residents of Stagville, a site in modern-day Durham County where 4 2-story slave quarters survive. How are such small dwellings used by the many enslaved African Americans who worked on the plantation as farm laborers, carpenters, weavers, blacksmiths, cooks, or gardeners? Where people lived in the antebellum era also influenced their everyday lives in important ways. Consider how the slave housing at Stagville and at the Bellamy Mansion in Wilmington documents various kinds of work and social life. How might life as an enslaved worker on a large plantation compare to such person's life in a city? Location mattered in other ways. Most North Carolinians were involved in farming, and region influenced the types of crops grown on a farm: cotton, brightleaf tobacco, corn, and wheat, to name a few. Prosperity on the farm affected prosperity of the surrounding community. Thomas Day's cabinet-making business boomed with the growth of commercial tobacco farming in the Caswell County area. In 1853, Day, a free man of color, participated in the Industrial Revolution just starting to take hold in the state. He bought a steam-powered engine to increase his busy shop's production. Wealthier families' homes, like the Bellamy Mansion, can reflect changes in technology during the 1800s, too. Articles in this magazine also suggest some of the ways that children received an education in the antebellum years: learning a trade as an apprentice, learning farming or domestic skills from a parent, or attending a new school like the Burwell School. Girls and boys often received different kinds of training for the distinct kinds of roles society expected them to play as adults. Keep in mind that not everything built during the antebellum period has survived. In many cases, the buildings that remain represent the best, most stylish, or sturdiest examples of the building boom. Small or yeoman farmers who owned an average of 100 acres of land and a few or no enslaved workers vastly outnumbered richer plantation owners in North Carolina. Far less evidence of yeoman life exists, however. In some cases, only parts of an antebellum landscape survive. On a large farm site, perhaps the main house remains, while the barn, corn crib, loom house, and slave dwellings have disappeared. Some sites have undergone a lot of reconstruction or restoration, while others remain largely as they were over 150 years ago. And some aspects of antebellum material life can be studied mainly through archaeology. Thus, you will not find a complete overview of this era in this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian. There are many more buildings and landscapes we might have included. As historian Bashir noted, hundreds of antebellum sites survive. Try to visit and study one in your own community. How does it fit the history of the 1800s presented in your textbook? Can you apply what you have learned from your book to understand the site and the society that built it? Once you have explored historic sites described in this magazine or located in your area, try rewriting your textbook's chapter on the antebellum era. What new information would you include? What else would you like to know? Considering a wide range of sources can help you learn to recognize and appreciate the evidence of the past that exists all around you. There's a quote with this article from B. from Baltimore in the Fayetteville Observer of September 1856. Time was when every North Carolinian in traveling from Wilmington to Weldon was certain to have his feelings wounded at the sneering remarks of scoffers and witlings as they defamed the old North State for her poverty of soil and primeval style of log cabin buildings. Since that time, a spirit of improvement has been abroad. Pine barrens have become fruitful. Wild weeds have given place to cereal grains, esculent herbs, and luscious fruits. And the modern, neatly painted mansions have long since supplanted the log cabins of the early pioneers. 16 years ago, I passed over the Wilmington and Weldon Railroad, and as I heard the carping, captious remarks of travelers from the sunny south and frozen north, I blushed, and dare not vindicate our state fame, so great were the odds against her. Recently, in passing over the same route, my state pride was exalted in listening to encomiums on the style of buildings, and crops of grain, and fruits, and grass that met the eye, as the steam horse sped along its iron track. There's also a sidebar called History in Sight, S-I-T-E. Log on to the website for Somerset Place State Historic Site in Creswell, www.nchistoricsites.org/Somerset, and you will see a list of structures located at Somerset. The list includes the Josiah Collins III family home, the enslaved community kitchen complex, the overseer's house, the salting house, the smokehouse, and the transportation canal. Right away, a glance at this list and at the photos on the website shows that the antebellum landscape of Somerset was quite different from that of a modern farm. Here are the kinds of questions that you might get you thinking about a site in your county. Why is the site located where it is? Who built or created the site? How and with what materials? How close is or was the site to similar and different sites or sites, buildings? How close is or was the site to a town? How has the location or region influenced the site or the type of buildings there? How does the site fit with or adapt to its environment and natural resources? How has the site changed since the antebellum era? How may structures survive compared to what was originally there? What purpose did each structure serve? What might the building size, style, or materials tell you about the people who used it, from their economic status to their daily lives? Does the site suggest something about social class, race, or gender during the era? Does the physical place reflect place in society? Does the site tell you anything about food preparation, transportation, settlement patterns, family life, culture, religion, politics, education, industry, technology, or recreation? How do any of the answers of these questions compare and contrast to your own experiences? Each article in this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian includes a sample from a primary source document that relates to the antebellum place being discussed. What primary sources might relate to sites in your community? Here are more antebellum places. Blandwood in Greensboro of Guilford County, www.blandwood.org. John Motley Moorhead, born in 1796 and died 1866, who served as North Carolina's governor from 1841 through 1845 and supported a program of progressive improvements, bought Blandwood in 1827. The Moorhead family, including five daughters and three sons, lived in what was then a six-room farmhouse begun in 1795. In 1844, Moorhead hired architect Alexander Jackson Davis, co-designer of the state capitol, to design an addition. This addition stands as the oldest surviving example of the Italianate style in the United States. During the 1840s and 1850s, Blandwood hosted many events and parties, including the weddings of the Moorhead daughters. Today, Blandwood has become a National Historic Landmark, devoted to reflecting regional culture and architecture of the 1700s and 1800s. The staff is conducting research on the enslaved people who lived on the property, as well as the role that Blandwood and its people played in the Civil War. There's a photograph with a caption, "Charles Bland built a four-room federal-style farmhouse in 1795 on a wooded hill in Guilford County before the founding of Greensboro in 1808. In 1822, Henry Humphreys, a textile mill owner, expanded the house to six rooms. It took on the appearance known today as Blandwood in the 1840s. Shaw House in Southern Pines in Moore County, www.moorehistory.com. Charles C. Shaw, a first-generation Scottish settler who acquired more than 2,000 acres, built the Shaw House around 1820 near the crossing of the P.D. and Morganton Roads, which became well known during the era of the American Revolution. The P.D. Road was actually an ancient American Indian trail that ran between Cheraw, South Carolina, and settlements to the northeast. Morganton Road ran from the market town of Fayetteville. The house is typical of antebellum houses that came a little later than the cabins of the earlier Sandhills settlers. It is less elaborate than Seacoast plantations, with the sturdy simplicity common among the Scottish families who immigrated to the region. Highlights inside include two hand-carved fireplace mantles, as well as examples of Moore County pottery and plain-style pine furniture from the antebellum era. A wing was added to the house in the mid-1800s, and a kitchen was added sometime in the 1920s. Historians believe that the date of 1842 on the chimney refers to the year that the front porch and the two attached travelers' rooms were added. The house remained in the family until it was acquired in 1946 by the newly formed Moore County Historical Association. It has also a photograph, and its caption is, "The Shaw House is the former residence of Charles Washington Shaw, who became the first mayor of Southern Pines in 1887. Today it focuses on antebellum life and serves as headquarters of the Moore County Historical Association." The Zachary Tolbert House in Cashiers in Jackson County, www.cashiershistoricalsociety.org. Built by Mordecai Zachary between 1842 and 1852, the Zachary Tolbert House offers a rare mountain example of Greek Revival-style architecture. This style, popular in the mid-1800s, includes columns on the front porch with side windows and transoms above the entrance door. Historians believe that future Confederate general and South Carolina governor Wade Hampton III provided the plans and may have helped with buying the hardware and glass in exchange for a place to stay during visits to the area. Through a combination of preservation and restoration, the house remains much as it was over 150 years ago, with no paint on its interior walls, no electricity, no plumbing, and no central heat. The Zachary family, including a 9-year-old Mordecai, were among the first white settlers of Cashiers Valley, arriving in 1832 to what was part of the vast lands of the Cherokee Indians. At age 19, Mordecai began a 10-year process of clearing land and building the house, turning felt trees into lumber at the family sawmill. He would live with his wife, Elvira Keener, in the home. It retains reminders of the couple's 12 children. A 13th was born after they moved. Several outbuildings and a 10-horse stable no longer stand. The Zacharys hosted boarders, mostly men wanting to hunt and fish, and supplemented their farming income with a sawmill, a grist mill, and carpentry. Several later owners used the house as a summer retreat. In 1997, it was donated to the Cashiers Historical Society. Early in the 1920s, the original kitchen behind the main house burned down. It was replaced with a wooden structure from a former logging operation at Whiteside Cove. Taken apart, transported, and reconstructed on the exact site with the original chimney, this building was carefully and historically restored in 2009. Its photograph has as its caption, "The Zachary Tolbert House contains much of its original furniture. It is recognized as the largest known collection of Southern plain-style furniture handmade by one person, Mordecai Zachary, in one place. The house features a lot of graffiti related to 12 Zachary children. The children learned to speak Cherokee as well as English from their mother, whose father was a Methodist minister to the American Indians." And there are stories at these other antebellum places: the Allison Deaver House in Transylvania County, the Acock Birthplace State Historic Site in Wayne County, Bennett Place State Historic Site, Durham County, the Buckner Hill House in Duplin County, Connemara in Henderson County, Creekside in Burke County, Darden Hotel in Martin County, Edenton's West King Street in Chowan County, the Hoffman Hotel, also known as the Gaston County Museum in Gaston County, Hope Plantation in Bertie County, Market House in Cumberland County, Mendenhall Plantation in Guilford County, the Pittsburgh Masonic Lodge in Chatham County, the Richmond Temperance and Literary Society Hall in Scotland County, Somerset Place State Historic Site in Washington County, the Smith McDowell House in Buncombe County, Walker's Inn in Cherokee County, Warren's Store in Caswell County, Widow's Son Masonic Lodge in Camden County, the Woodfield Inn in Henderson County, and the Wright Tavern in Rockingham County. Next, determining age with limited records. North Carolina did not require birth or death certificates until 1913, so researchers sometimes must guess a person's birthday and death date based on other sources. The best source can be a family Bible or a tombstone. When those are not available, we examine public records such as United States Census records, court records, and land records. Newspapers can also tell us when people died, but not everyone's death appears in the paper. Census records note how old a person was when that census was taken. If we subtract that age from the year of the census, we can get an estimate of when a person was born. For example, Rebecca Everett is listed as 80 in the 1860 census, which would make her birth around 1780. We do not know what month she was born in, so we cannot be exact. We can usually tell roughly when the census information was gathered. In the 1810 census, the female listed in the Silas Everett household is between 20 and 45. Since we think Rebecca was born around 1780, her age in 1810 for the census would be 30, which falls in the age range given. We can estimate death dates based on when a will was presented in court. When a person writes a will or has a lawyer write one, the date it was written is listed on the will. When a person dies, the will is presented in the next court session. The document then becomes an official record and property can be given to the heirs, the people who inherit land or other property from the person who died. County courts only met 4 times a year during the antebellum period. We know that the person died sometime between the last court date and the one in which the will is recorded. Both of the Everett's wills were presented in February court, which means they died sometime that winter, between November of the previous year and February of the year in which the will was presented. We do not have an exact date, but we do have about a 3-month time frame. Because we know Rebecca was listed in the 1860 census as being 80 years old, and her will was presented in court in February 1865, we know she was about 84 or 85 when she died. Material culture is historical research. When there are no photographs or written stories like diaries, historians can use buildings, household items, and public records to try to understand how people lived. Studying household items is known as material culture because the researchers are looking at the material items left behind. Material does not mean made of cloth. Any piece of furniture, tool, toy, or object in the house could be an artifact or part of material culture. One way to discover the items contained in a house is to use an estate record or inventory. When someone died without a will in the 1800s, the county sheriff was ordered to go to his or her home and make an inventory of every item on the property, furniture, tools, kitchen items, and even animals. Then the belongings could be sold at public auction. By reading these inventories, historians can make educated guesses about how people lived. The type of tools may reveal the type of work the person did. For example, a spinning wheel might indicate someone spun cotton or wool into thread. A loom could mean the person wove cloth. A plow could point out that the person farmed. Most antebellum farm families did many kinds of work, of course. The inventory could also tell us whether an antebellum family had wealth, if they owned 1 or 2 beds, and 1 table and 3 chairs. But we knew there were 8 people in the family, then we would know the family was not very well off. Most furniture was homemade and would not cost much at auction. Furniture custom made by a craftsman would have been worth more. The way people used rooms in a house helps us learn how they lived too, because most antebellum houses were so small, rooms often served many purposes. The large room in the Everett's house would have been where the family ate, read, or wrote letters and performed a lot of work. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.